Hello, I'm Elizabeth Pauker, and welcome to Indivisible 101 here on WBAI 99.5 FM, a non-commercial, listener-supported Pacifica Foundation radio station here in New York City. I'm a Brooklyn activist, originally from Queens, New York, and I'm a member of Indivisible Nation BK.
And I'm Steve Wagner. I'm a personal injury trial lawyer, also a Brooklyn activist and member of Indivisible Nation BK.
Every week, we'll be delving into different topics on the city, state, and local level. We'll be interviewing politicians, local activists, and community leaders about tools and strategies for engaging in politics and making your voice heard by our government. Last week, Brooklyn activists Lisa and Liat gave an overview of Indivisible and the tools you can use for activism. This week, we'll be discussing one specific tool in detail, nonviolent protesting. Next week, we'll be discussing civil disobedience as a form of protest, so make sure to tune in for that as well.
The right to join with fellow citizens in protest or peaceful assembly is a critical part of a functioning democracy and at the core of the First Amendment. Over the past few years, there have been a number of protest movements that have really gained traction. Black Lives Matter, which started in 2013, has kept the subject of racial justice in law enforcement in the national spotlight. The women's marches, which started the day after Trump's inauguration on January 21st, 2017, brought about the largest day of protests in American history, with approximately 4 million people taking to the streets in hundreds of cities.
While we're on the subject, it only seemed right to bring in our guest today, L.A. Kaufman, who has literally written the book, actually books, as she has written two, on protesting, How to Read a Protest, The Art of Organizing and Resistance, and Direct Action, Protest and the Reinvention of American Radicalism. L.A. Kaufman, thanks for joining us and welcome to the show.
Thank you. I'm pleased to be here.
So you have been an activist, an organizer, and a protester for over 30 years. What was the first protest you ever went to, and why did you go?
Well, I first got involved in organizing when I was a teenager in high school in Waukesha County, Wisconsin. I got active around reproductive rights, particularly for young women. There were threats to abortion rights in Wisconsin in that period. And the first big protest march I went to was actually in Illinois. It was a march for the Equal Rights Amendment in 1982, right on the eve of the failure of the Equal Rights Amendment. So it was a big march for a cause where we didn't win, but I kept marching. I kept organizing after that.
So why did you keep going back?
I think there was something about the community that I found in the organizing meetings. I was involved in the National Organization for Women in Milwaukee, and on the streets going in Illinois and being in this massive crowd of people that who felt the way I did. That to me was deeply moving, and you know, this was at a time, this was 1982, the internet didn't exist. It was harder to find you know, people who shared your beliefs, and that possibility and that sense of enacting my views with my body in the streets with others, just I found very compelling.
Why do you go from participating in protests to writing about them?
Well, I've been a journalist since, you know, not long after that. I mean, I've been a journalist as well as an organizer through my whole career. So so I've always been interested in both being active on the front lines, in the mix, on the ground, in various causes, and then reflecting on them, and particularly reflecting on them in a long historical view.
So talking about history, I think we want to start kind of with the biggest protest that people think about when they think about protesting, which is the 1963 March on Washington. And I was surprised to read in your book, How to Read a Protest, that there was actually a drop in enthusiasm right after the march. And I was wondering why that was, why there was this drop in enthusiasm from people who participated in the march after the march itself.
Right. Well, so what part of what that points to is that when we talk about what protests do and how they work, part of that question boils down to how they're perceived and how they're understood afterwards, not necessarily what happened, but what people think happened. And so there's a real contrast with the 63 March on Washington, where it's become, you know, one of the hallowed events of American history, and it's been rightly celebrated as a moment that brought together huge numbers of people for an unprecedented gathering for civil rights, particularly for African American civil rights in this country. And so we tend to lose sight that, you know, this was an event put on by real people who were, you know, flawed and had strengths and weaknesses and who get tired and who get burned out. And the work of organizing that mobilization, it was a very ambitious mobilization. There had been nothing like it before. There had never been a mass march on that scale in the U.S. And the effort of putting it together ended up really exhausting the organizations that did the work. And they weren't able to, you know, what sometimes people call absorb the energy of the mobilization. They, you know, when I went back and I looked at the membership rules of the different co-sponsoring organizations, like the NAACP for the next year had a short-term bump in fundraising, but none of them turned it, it didn't turn into like more membership, more activists, or ongoing strength. Part of that's the larger political climate that they were operating in, that march came at a point where people at the grassroots, at the local level, were growing frustrated with the pace of change, and people were feeling burned out for that reason, because the violence against the Black civil rights movement had been so unrelenting. But, you know, just because an event looks in retrospect to have been a stunning success doesn't actually mean it worked in every single way. And so that's one way that that event actually didn't work. It didn't build the organizations that put it on. That doesn't mean it's a failure. It's just when we think about our organizing today, it's useful to have an accurate picture of what happened in the past.
So what's the magic secret? How do we make it? How do we translate mass protest into actual on-the-ground change? How do we avoid that pitfall, if possible, for example, avoiding exhaustion?
Well, there's a big question about how you avoid exhaustion and, you know, what kind of pacing is important. But I think it's important to point to the fact that what happened with the first round of women's marches was exactly the opposite, and that there really weren't organizations. There were organizations who helped make it happen, but no organization called it. There was no pre-existing organization that brought it into being. Instead, it became this container and this space that set people and energy in motion in a way that led to the founding of, for example, Indivisible Nation BK, right? The thousands of local indivisible groups. They weren't founded at the women's marches, but you can't really imagine them having started without that burst of energy. And this was an example where people coming together and marching energize people and galvanize people, and people went home and they were like, okay, now I really want to get to work. And they found, you know, in the case of the Indivisible Guide, happened to be ready then, so that it was something that people could grab onto and run ahead. You know, had there been other things available, like had something totally different been available, you know, we might have seen a different picture of where resistance work mostly took shape and took form. But I think you know, so many things about the character of the resistance to Trump were shaped in that early moment, in that kind of passing of the baton of this energy from marching that didn't dissipate and didn't leave people just exhausted. People were energized.
So that's interesting that you mentioned that, because I've actually heard some people, when I've talked to them, are you going to go to the follow-up women's marches? They have this sense of, well, what did it do? And to me, it feels like it did a huge amount. But I think there's a lot of people that don't know how are protests effective? What are they succeeding? And you've written a lot about how we really need to redefine for ourselves and lead that narrative about whether a protest was successful or not. So could you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, well, there's a lot of misconceptions around protest, because first of all, there's a lot of different kinds. I mean, you mentioned the next week you're talking about civil disobedience. That's a very distinctive kind of protest. It usually draws smaller numbers of people who are taking a stronger form of action. And the way it works is different from when you're trying to get 500,000, 750,000, a million people in the streets. Actually, those huge mobilizations work less well as pressure tactics than a direct action with 12 people, usually. Usually those mass mobilizations are You don't get people in motion on that scale usually unless it's a really broad agenda that isn't susceptible to just like pressuring for one change that you can win and then you can count on that you won, right? I mean, smaller direct actions are often really targeted around a local fight, for instance, with winnable stakes, so you could win or lose, like, you know, the bulldozing a community garden or some development project or something, you know, something that's very specific and concrete. Big mobilizations tend to be around big questions. So how do you measure whether they worked or not? Sometimes it's obvious. For instance, I was the mobilizing coordinator for the huge protests against the Iraq War, which failed to stop the Iraq War. That was a clear case where, you know, getting huge numbers of people in the streets didn't make the change we wanted. But when you look at something like, say, Occupy Wall Street, right, which didn't have a specific goal or a specific agenda, specific demands, you can look at it and evaluate it by, like, did Wall Street shut down that week? Did they disrupt business as usual for a couple of days? Or you can look at it for what did it catalyze? And how did it change conversations? And how did it shift the terms of debate and put issues on the agenda that weren't there before? All of these kinds of things that people, you know, who aren't working, who have money and resources might be hiring, you know, consulting firms to try to change the national conversation around banking and inequality and student debt. The banking lobby spends tons of money to try to change the conversation. You can oftentimes, when you look back at a protest movement, see all kinds of changes that are things that you almost can't perceive while they're happening, because they're setting, it's not the people protesting who are making the change, it's how the people protesting are affecting others around them and are shifting a whole larger field of society.
Well, at this point, I think we should open up to callers. Anybody?
Yeah. We are going to open up the phone lines for listener calls. So feel free to give us a call at 212-209-2877. That's 212-209-2877. Give us a call with your questions or comments about protesting.
And for those just tuning in, this is Indivisible 101, an activist radio show on WBAI 99.5 FM. We are a listener-sponsored, non-commercial radio here in New York, and we're talking about protest with L.A. Kaufman. She's the activist and author of How to Read a Protest, The Art of Organizing Resistance, and Direct Action Protest and the Reinvention of American Radicalism. We have a caller. Hello, you're on the air with WBAI. Go ahead.
Yes, I'd like to know, as far as information out there, how do we know who is behind the journalists, the think tank, the editors, the PR companies, the marketing companies, the advertising companies? How does one know, you know, we see articles in various magazines and newspapers, how do we know who is behind the article, and also, is it editorial, and also, is it some kind of manipulation? How do we know that it's objective, and can it be objective?
So we have some questions about misinformation, and also a related thought would be, what about astroturfing? So we've heard about that term, which is kind of people being paid to protest. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, I think astroturfing, paying people to protest, has been a common right-wing tactic. We've seen they use it a lot, and much as Donald Trump projects, and the right often projects and accuses the left of doing what they do, they accuse us of being paid. I really wish more of us were. I wish it were easy. because it's actually a lot of work goes into organizing a good protest, and I can't tell you how little compensation I've gotten over 35 years of doing it. There've been occasional times when I had a staff position in an organization that's open, that I'm like being paid a salary to do organizing work, and I think that's honorable and legitimate work. But this idea that people are paid for protesting, what it does is it deflects attention away. Like people were saying that during the Kavanaugh protests, right? And, you know, who was getting the big bucks? It was like the Judicial Watch Network and the Federalist Society, these entrenched right-wing lobbying organizations with staffs who are earning way higher salaries than anybody I know in the activist left has ever earned, in order to subvert democracy and to push a right-wing judicial agenda very aggressively. Like, that never gets pointed out. You know, people get upset because crowdsourced donations get used to bail people out of jail. You know, that's about as close as we get to paid protesting, is that people will donate to funds, you know, to pay for people's bail costs so that they can get out if they get arrested at a protest.
It's a nice perk.
Yeah.
Thank you.
It makes up for the bologna sandwiches and the hours under, in police custody. Not quite, but.
Thank you so much for calling, sir. I think we have another question.
Hi, you're on the air.
I am.
Yes, you are. Go ahead.
What's your name and from where are you calling?
Yes, this is Diane from the Bronx.
Hi, Diane.
Is this a new show that's on?
This is our second episode. We just started last Thursday, and we will be on the air every Thursday from 7 to 7:30. Thank you so much for calling.
Okay. All right. That sounds interesting. I hope I'm on topic, but I heard the discussion about participation, in actions or marches, and I've done at least a couple of the climate change. I was very excited to, be part of that. But it's kind of, there's a letdown at the end. Okay, all right, we've been there. You're meeting up with a lot of people, and I got to connect with people doing things in the Bronx, which I thought was really good. But I wasn't able to attend the one with the young girl, Greta. But in terms of afterwards, at least this particular time, I thought it was so, inspiring, okay, to have, such a young person being involved in it, that I felt, I need to do something with that, particularly with young people. And so I'm moving forward with trying to work with my my after-school group to do something. But in terms of when you
raise a particular question for our guest about what kind of work you could do? Go ahead.
Well, yes. The question was, okay, when these things are being done, it seems like there needs to be what's the next step? And maybe there should be something thought being done with make some simple, next steps for people to do. So at least you can kind of walk away from the event feeling, look, I got an idea of what I could do.
Well, thank you so much for calling. I really appreciate that question. So the question is, what are the next steps you can do to get people from marching on the streets to joining organizations like ours, Indivisible Nation BK? For example, signing people up, could you pass something out? What are some thoughts on harnessing that energy?
Right. I mean, the caller is right to point that a lot of times the most important question about a demonstration isn't what happens there, but is what people are inspired to do afterwards because they were there. And it's always ideal when there's specific concrete action steps that people can do or ways that they can plug into groups. A lot of times after big mobilizations, people will have some kind of fair, we used to have peace and justice fairs when we had the anti-war marches, and there'd be all kinds of booths of organizations where you can get involved and get specific ideas for next action steps. You know, they had that back at the 63 March in Washington. They had these pledge cards for people to sign, but it was just kind of a generic pledge, and the idea was to get people involved. I always like it when people have sort of stacking functions in an action. Like if you're designing an action that's say, protesting Fox News. So you're just like holding a protest outside Fox News. So it's the kind of thing where you're saying bad things are bad, right? But you're trying to make a visible display of opposition. I think using that also as a way to recruit new members to your group by having outreach material. So people who are like, cool, I'm so glad you're out here protesting Fox News. How do I get involved, right? Having, you know, or here's the number of somebody you can call to complain that, you know, that Fox News is violating oversight regulations and have a specific action step that people can take. I think it's great when you can stack those things. But ultimately, you know, the very most powerful protests do like what the Women's March did, which is that they inspire people to just go figure it out and like just get together and do organizing and do action together. We know that, you know, on something like the climate crisis, there's all kinds of toolkits and action guides out there. You just need a quick Google search to get specific ideas of things you can do in your community. It sounded like this caller already is working with an after-school program. And that's the magic, is when people just, you know, are catalyzed to take action in their own way, in their own community or context or family or faith institution, wherever it may be.
And also, I will mention that if you go to our website, Indivisible Nation BK, we do call scripts about twice a week, usually in relation to whatever's happening politically, following up on a variety of protests and actions. And we give scripts for who you can call and what you can say to have your voice heard.
And besides indivisiblenationbk.org, you can also find us on Twitter. Our handle is @BKIndivisible.
I think we have another caller. Hello, this is Indivisible 101 on WBAI. You're on the air. What's your name and where are you calling from?
Hi, my name is Joe from calling from Tarrytown, New York.
Hi, Joe. Do you have a question or comment?
I do. Many of the protests, I guess, that we talk about and that are mentioned tend to be more left-wing, I guess. But if Trump is impeached, do you see protests from kind of the other side, more of a right-wing protest? If so, how do you see that looking? Do you see it turning more violent than maybe we'd hope?
I mean, protests are what the anthropologist James Scott called weapons of the weak, right? People don't protest who don't have power. I mean, who do have power. Protest is a set of techniques that you use because you are relatively less empowered in the situation. And so for that reason, we have not had the same traditions of right-wing protests as of left-wing protests. But I think, you know, I think you can't think about Donald Trump's presidency without thinking about those rallies that he has, which are they're not exactly a protest, because a protest is a participatory collaborative event. These are, you know, hero-worshipping pep rallies. But there's something about the fact that he's bringing people together in physical space that is a shared quality with protest, and that I think does matter. I mean, I think, you know, sometimes what you do when you're having a big protest march is you are having a kind of pep rally. You're improving the morale on your side. And it's funny, you know, armies think about morale all the time and about how to keep the morale of troops up all the time. Companies think about how to keep the morale of their employees up all the time. And movements, which are volunteer endeavors, sometimes don't think about that enough. And so I think, you know, the right wing, the Trump rallies have been an obviously ominous and menacing set of public events, but they've clearly performed that function, that function of making people feel part of something bigger than themselves. And I think when we think about what we're doing out in the streets and the kind of spaces that we're creating to fight for democracy and fight for values of justice and equality, it's really important to think about creating spaces that are inviting and welcoming, where we have joy and beauty and art, and that are not just spaces for venting anger, however angry we might be at the current state of affairs, because it's those qualities of that are attractive qualities, where we're holding up a vision of the world we want to create, that's what really sustains people. Anger, it can feel good to scream when you're angry, but over time that just becomes corrosive, and you can't really stay in a fight just out of anger. You need that sense of community as well.
I'm going to follow that up by asking, what can we do about protest fatigue? There are protests, if not every day, certainly every week and every month under the Trump administration.
Right. Well, I think that people do have to pace themselves, and that it's important not to overdo and to recognize when you're feeling worn out that, you know, maybe you do something different. Like if you're wanting to stay engaged, maybe you go to one of the postcard writing parties, or, you know, maybe you make phone calls, or maybe you take a break altogether. I mean, I've been doing this kind of work for more than 3 decades. I've had some long chunks of time when I just checked out. It can feel hard to do that given the urgency of the threats we face. And of course, right now, as we're in this impeachment crisis, I think there's going to be more and more calls for people to be out in the street and standing up for democracy and for our basic rights of political participation and for the Constitution. I sort of think, like I always am, like, don't march near the band, don't march near the bullhorn. Like you burn out if you're just chanting slogans over and over again. Like, yeah. You know, I always sort of like look for some of the joy in the streets. Go with friends. Think about, you know, in the way that you would think if you're going on like a long hike, you know, you would be bringing snacks and you'd be making sure that you had like a change of socks to make you like thinking about creature comfort when you're participating in protests.
Comfortable
shoes, all that kind of, you know, like good food, like good protein. You know, some of the fatigue is actually physical fatigue.
I find that bringing a funny sign will get people to come up to you and take pictures, and that gives me a great sense of joy. So that keeps me going.
I think we have one last call, and it has to be a little bit quick. But hi, this is Indivisible 101 on WBAI. You're on the air. What's your name, and where are you calling from?
Hey, I'll just keep that anonymous if it's okay.
Yeah, that's fine. Do you have a question or comment?
Cool. Both. I have a comment, which is just to totally say thank you, L.A. Kaufman, for holding down the fort all these years. For example, at the climate march, people were like sardines around Battery Park, just staring at each other, going in opposite directions, like not seeing anything, I was like, yo, the raging grannies are up ahead. Everybody give thanks because we get the crap beat out of us right now if it wasn't for people like that holding down the fort by the cops. So anybody who's listening, we all, you know, non-union training, so don't even try it because we all are trained in revenge. And so the other thing is that's a wonderful idea that you, like, the whole thing, march near the band instead of doing a bullhorn because it's like preaching that we've been murdered. And making it fun to avoid the burnout. I bring bubbles and, like, you know, it's so smart. And two questions. One, were you with UFPJ or with the Answer folks? Because your name sounds familiar. And then the other thing is
UFPJ.
And I'm so sorry. We do have to cut you off there just because our show is just about to be off. But thank you so much for calling, and you can tweet at us or tweet at L.A. Kaufman, and she can answer your other question. That's it for this week, folks. Thanks to everyone who called in and to our guest, L.A. Kaufman. We'll be answering your questions every week, so feel free to tweet your questions at us anytime, #AskINBK, or call in live next Thursday.
You can find out more about activism and upcoming protests by visiting our website, www.indivisiblenationbk.org. Signing up for our weekly newsletter, and also following us on Twitter. Our handle is @BKIndivisible. Indivisible Nation BK's meetings are the first Wednesday of every month at 7 p.m. at the Brooklyn Commons Cafe on Atlantic Avenue in Brooklyn. Have a great week, and remember, don't despair, organize.
Stand up for your right. Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right. daily work is that all that Peter is gold. After story had never been told, so now you see the light. Hey, stand up for your right. Come on,
get up, stand up, stand up for your right.